You're listening to Bottom Shelf Bitcoin. This is episode 39. Hey everybody, welcome back to another episode of Bottom Shelf Bitcoin, the podcast that puts Bitcoin knowledge within everyone's reach. As always, I'm your host, Josh Humphrey, and today my guest is author of the Proof of Take newsletter and Bitcoin enthusiast, Alex Hardy. Alex, welcome.
Hey Josh, great to be here. Very, very excited to join the show.
Yeah, I'm excited as well. I finally got some recording equipment, and so this is the this is the first interview on this equipment. So in-person interview. So I'm excited about that. So Alex, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself and then kind of maybe your background and how you got into Bitcoin?
Sure. So currently I'm the chief operating officer at a financial software startup called Live Oak Technologies, not directly crypto related, but I do work very closely with banks and insurance companies. So I see how they sometimes struggle to innovate. But my Bitcoin origin story dates back all the way to 2013, when I tried to get a job at Coinbase when they were about 20 people. And God bless Dan Romero at DWR. He is now, I think, a GM there. But he and I went to college together, and he tried very hard to get me a job at Coinbase when they were still kind of fledgling and, you know, just somewhat fresh out of Y Combinator. And I tried, and I just didn't really get Bitcoin. I didn't understand it. I had Visa that worked really well. I had Venmo or, you know, PayPal that worked really well. So I couldn't really explain, and I didn't get Bitcoin's value proposition. So I didn't get the job at Coinbase. But fortunately, as part of my diligence process in the interview, I bought a Bitcoin. This was when Bitcoin was at about $500. And when I didn't get the job, I just forgot about it. And woke up last year and it had, you know, 10 or 15x, and that the price action definitely got me back interested. The other angle that got me interested was Buddhism, actually. And so over the last couple of years, I've gotten very interested in Buddhism and meditation. And one of the fundamental teachings of Buddhism is that we suffer because we're deluded in how we see reality. We don't see reality clearly. And a big reason that we don't see reality clearly is because we're constantly telling ourselves these stories in our head about how the world is. And these stories aren't true, but we believe them so deeply that they grip us, and they kind of, you know, control how we behave and our emotions and things like that. And when you think about it, money is the ultimate story that we tell ourselves. It's not backed by anything. It's not real. It's green pieces of paper or entries in a database, but it generally runs the world. So when I started to question a lot of things about consciousness, questioning the stories that I tell myself, questioning the story of money was a logical next one. And so that also was how I rediscovered and got excited about Bitcoin.
Very cool. So, I saw in your latest, what would you call it? Issue, I guess, of Proof of Take, you talked a lot about the Buddhism thing. I want to get back into that in a little bit. So when did you start writing Proof of Take? Tell us a little bit about that and like why you chose that name. And
Yeah. So like many people, I felt very overwhelmed by all of the various news sources, trying to keep up with crypto Twitter and Reddit and Telegram and a bunch of the different media properties was extremely difficult. So when I was first re-entering the rabbit hole, I would say, which was kind of mid 2017, I was really frustrated that there was no so many low quality news sources, you know, on the internet. When it's free to publish, the bar to publish is quite low. So I wanted, and the other thing that I took issue with was that so much of the content was very short term and short-sighted. So it was, you know, takes on what the latest price action was or takes on, you know, some bit of news. And this, you know, the shelf life of this content was very, was so clearly like days or weeks, not months or years.
Oh, so, yeah, absolutely.
So I wanted to put content out there that was, would be kind of evergreen and that would have, a life, you know, a longer lifespan. And so I started the newsletter, I think in about May or June of last year. And Proof of Take, the name was just a pun, what I thought to be a clever pun on Proof of Stake. And I wanted to timestamp my takes and hopefully, you know, create a, you know, a portfolio of writing that I could point back to and kind of chronicle the journey to hyper Bitcoinization that we're all on.
Very cool. So, just because you mentioned proof of stake, what's your thought then on, are you Bitcoin only? Are you multi-coin? What's your view on that?
Yeah. I've had a little bit of a different path than most. I was never really into the altcoins. I was kind of an ardent no coiner until I got into Bitcoin. I really thought that the existing financial system was, you know, working out well enough for me and that the global hegemony of the US dollar was pretty strong and would kind of never get toppled. So I didn't really see the need. I casually follow, you know, a few other projects. I don't hold anything other than Bitcoin. And, you know, for me, it's not that I am trying to disparage or, you know, put down what people working on other projects are doing. I think, you know, you work on what you think is important and certain people have different views of that than I do, certainly. But for me, the separation of money and state that Bitcoin is going to usher in is just such a massively important human endeavor that I can't really justify spending a lot of time working on anything else. So I try to not participate in kind of you know, the Twitter the Twitter fights that often start between people of different tribes. But yeah, I'm focused certainly primarily on Bitcoin.
So you talk about, I reread through some of your stuff last night, and I really like how you talk a lot about reputation and character. Why is reputation such a big deal?
Reputation is a big deal in a lot of ways because of how the internet has changed society and has totally flipped our notion of reputation on its head. So if you think back to when, you know, in the days before the internet and even before mass communication, we were typically living in relatively smaller groups. You know, even all the way up ahead of the Industrial Revolution, you probably lived in a small town and didn't know more than 50 or 100 or 150 different people. And so in that world, your reputation was extremely important because these people were your tribe and you kind of all relied on each other to survive. And so reputation is really pretty deeply coded into our DNA and our you know, ancestral history. So reputation is what the rest of the tribe thinks of you. And up until somewhat recently, that carried a ton of weight. Now, the internet kind of interestingly gives us access to more people and interactions than we've ever had before. And so how you can port this notion of reputation, which was very easy to you know, calibrate back in when we were all living in Meatspace, onto the internet and have it be reliable is a topic that has fascinated me, and where I think, you know, we've seen some of the harm that that the internet can cause via reputation is just how easy it is to attack someone's reputation online. And whether it's, you know, substantiated or not, you know, there's the Warren Buffett quote that your reputation takes a lifetime to build up and a second to destroy. And on the internet, the friction to destroy someone's reputation is reduced even further.
Oh yeah. And there's no, you don't have to wait for evidence when we're talking about, you know, when people are tearing other people down, there it feels like there's very little need for evidence. It's just like accusation is all that's required to destroy someone's career.
Yeah. Yeah. The Twitter mob shoots first and asks questions later. That's very much their MO. And, you know, there's this notion in the American justice system. I went to law school, and so I do have kind of like a legal background. And there's this notion in the American justice system in the Constitution of due process. So everyone, no matter what you're accused of and no matter whether you actually did it or not, that you're entitled to due process, to have your day in court. And unfortunately, in the court of public opinion, there is no due process. And that's just a fundamental characteristic of this new world we're living in that we're going to have to get used to.
So do you think it's good or bad, or it's just it is what it is and we need to figure out how to deal with it?
Yeah, I try not to make too normative or qualitative judgments of these things. I think this is the new reality, and we have to accept it. Whether I like it or dislike it is somewhat irrelevant. I think the people that can adapt to it most quickly are going to be best equipped to live in this new world we're living in, and this the kind of changing paradigm that the internet has given. We may be getting into it later, but The Sovereign Individual is one of my favorite books, and it's a very well regarded book within a lot of the cryptoverse, and it talks to this point about how the internet is changing reputation quite a bit.
We'll talk about it because I haven't read it yet. It's on my list, but it's a long list.
Yeah, it's a good one. It's funny because it's not available on Kindle. It's not available on audiobook. You really have to actually hunt down a paper copy of it and read it old school. So in that way, it's somewhat different than many of the books that you might come across. But basically, the thesis is that the internet has kind of uniquely enabled a lot of different business models and a lot of different models of human organization, basically, particularly when it comes to governments. So the Sovereign Individual was written in about 1997 or 1998, and it has some unbelievably prescient predictions that it makes. It predicts Bitcoin. It predicts Donald Trump, not by name, but, you know, people like him. It predicts kind of the global uprising in populism generally. And it theorizes that the idea of the nation state that we are currently living in, that the world has organized around, has maybe outlived its usefulness. And that, you know, in our lifetime, we could see the decline of the nation state as an institution. And that every time that the kind of way that the world is organized changes dramatically, and it, you know, this happens every 500 years or so, something like that, the people that are affected by it don't realize that the change has happened until it's too late. So it's the book would kind of suggest that the change happens slowly and then all at once, because you don't realize that Rome has fallen until after, you know, the barbarians are already at the gate. And they use that example specifically, that people thought that Rome was still when the Roman Empire fell. You know, there were people that were still clinging on to the notion of it being real hundreds of years after the empire, quote unquote, fell. So people will hold on to their stories, back to what I was saying before, shared stories. And America is a shared story that we all have, just like the dollar is a shared story that we all have, and people like to hold on to their stories.
Yeah, for sure. Kind of shifting gears, being part of a startup, we see a lot of startups that go chasing after the next thing. Like, why are so many startups trying to push either support or push something that they see as like the next Bitcoin or the next, you know, whatever blockchain everything?
Yeah, this is one of my favorite questions to think about. I think you can have a cynical view, or you can have a more charitable view towards some of these projects. But we can start with the cynical view. So on the cynical side, I think, you know, the quickest path to a massive increase in wealth is not buying Bitcoin today, because there's no pre-sale that you can have on Bitcoin. There's no discount or favorable terms. It's quite egalitarian. So the quickest way on a purely selfish individual basis is to probably create something that could credibly surpass Bitcoin, or even if it only takes up, you know, a fraction of what Bitcoin will eventually be, since you were the creator of it, or very, very early on, you have that much more upside. And so I think, you know, it's not that, so it's, to be, you know, as cynical as possible, it's a purely selfish, economic calculation, and nothing more. I do think, you know, to be more charitable, there are people that reasonably believe that there are flaws in Bitcoin, or that money is not an interesting enough use case, and that they want to have other projects become decentralized and censorship resistant. And so they although they may be being a bit naive, they genuinely believe that their Bitcoin competitor, or their, you know, XYZ on the blockchain is more important and potentially more valuable than Bitcoin. And so that's why they're pursuing it.
We'll be back with more Bottom Shelf Bitcoin in a minute. But first, let me tell you about the sponsors of this show.
If you've been listening to the show recently, you'll know I launched BitcoinMeritBadge.com, an online store where you can buy Velcro-backed patches to celebrate accomplishments and culture in Bitcoin. It's a great way to support my work and show off your love for Bitcoin at the same time. But what you might not know is that my manufacturer, Patcheon, is also a Bitcoin-friendly business. Patcheon has been accepting Bitcoin since 2011 and accepts on-chain and Lightning Network Bitcoin, as well as a handful of other cryptocurrency payments. Patcheon will work with you to build custom embroidered patches to fit your need, including various backings like adhesive and Velcro. There's no minimum order, so whether you want a big patch or a small patch, one or 1,000, Patcheon is your stop for custom embroidered patches. Check them out today at patcheon.uk.
Have you had any kind of conversations where you try and talk someone out of doing something on the blockchain? Like, I know for me, I have a friend at our local meetup who's very into a few projects, and I'm, you know, there's a couple of us that are primarily Bitcoiners, and we're, you know, always kind of needling him, like, but why does it need a blockchain? You know, like, I, in my view, very few things do. So have you had any of those kind of conversations?
Yeah. I would agree that very few things do. I think that for a lot of people, you can't really make them, you can't force Bitcoinism upon them until they're ready.
Right, yeah.
So I do like asking that question, though. Why does it need a blockchain? But I kind of I try and bring it back to on that note that you know, very few things require censorship resistance, and money is absolutely one of them. And when we get into that conversation, I like to ask them, what is money to them? Just that question straight up. And you'd be amazed how many people have not thought deeply about this thing money that is 50% of every transaction that we make. So getting them back focused on money and what it is and why it's important and who controls it, I think is kind of the best way to Trojan horse them into Bitcoin.
Yeah. That's something I'm learning in the last couple of years, is that you can't force someone to change their mind on something, but asking questions and making them kind of think about and defend their current position a lot of times causes people to really question it for the first time. And sometimes you can get some traction there.
Yeah.
So what would you say you are most excited about moving forward in the Bitcoin space right now?
Well, I mean, I think at the actual protocol and layer two level, you know, there's some really exciting things around privacy and fungibility that are hopefully going to be, merged in on the somewhat near term. Super excited about and bullish on Lightning. Very excited about what some of the larger incumbents, you know, Square, I think, seems to have a really favorable Bitcoin view. There's been a lot of good and interesting developments coming out of Fidelity, and some of their they seem to have really embraced the cypherpunk ethos and a lot of what they're doing. So I think at the micro level, it's things like that. I think at the macro level, you know, I can't help but wonder what will be the next catalyst for a major price run, because we know that it's going to happen and that these things are cyclical, and that we're obviously in a bear market now, but what will cause the next kind of parabolic increase? And you know, it's fun to fantasize. Will it be that Trump tweets about Bitcoin, or will it be that, you know, some third world dictator, you know, makes a massive OTC deal to buy a ton of Bitcoin that gets out, or you know, that a country central bank ends up pegging to Bitcoin? You know, these kind of farther out developments are things that you just can't help but wonder about.
Yeah. So what would you say, kind of going back to what you were talking about with the lies that we tell ourselves and some of that kind of thing, what are some things that you see either just in crypto in general or specifically in Bitcoin? Like what are things that you see as holding us back that we cling to?
That's a good question. I think that there's this idea, people have difficulty, and I reference it, excuse me, in my post yesterday, that there's this story about the blind man and the elephant, where this group of blind men gets brought to an elephant, and one guy gets put at the tail, and one guy gets put at the leg, and one guy gets put at the trunk, and the person that brings them there asks each of them, what is this? Like, what are you touching? And the guy in the tail, who's touching the tail, says, oh, it's a rope. And the guy that's touching the leg says, oh, it's a tree. And the guy that's touching the trunk says, oh, it's a snake. And so the point of this is that each of them isn't necessarily wrong, but they're seeing an incomplete view of the whole thing. And that, you know, Bitcoin can be Bitcoin can be different things to different people, and that's okay. They're not mutually exclusive. Pierre Rochard has a great piece that's the various investment theses of Bitcoin, and there's, you know, 20 or 30 different things that are on there. And so I think, you know, when people get into Twitter arguments over, no, it's a store of value versus, you know, no, it's a hedge against inflation versus no, it's a check on government tyranny. You know, there are many different, it can be all of them. And at the end of the day, you know, we're still in the early price discovery phase about what the best job for it is. And so I think that's a lie, that it has to be one thing, and that it may not change is certainly one that we that many on crypto Twitter tell ourselves.
Yeah, for sure. Well, and that's what, I don't remember who I was even talking to the other day. You know, they were saying, well, how do you, I guess they had friends that had bought in last year, right? Not last year, 2017. I forget, we're in the new year now. You know, when in the price run up, and you know, that we're mad at them now because the price has gone down, and they were saying, how do I convince someone that, you know, this is still a thing? How do I convince them it's a store of value? And I was just kind of saying, well, you need to go back and ask them, like, one, why they're even in this. You know, and I said, and it depends on your use case, because, you know, like you were saying, like for somebody in a, how do I want to say this? A less hostile environment, let's say, you know, you and me, maybe it's a store, a hedge against inflation or something like that. But for people in Venezuela, it's a real thing right now to has a real day-to-day use case. So yeah, it doesn't always have to be the same thing for everybody.
Yeah, totally. I think, you know, the other thing that I, when people who bought in 2017 or, you know, at the peak, express regret, you know, I try and introduce them to the notion of time preference. And that's been popularized by Saifedean in the Bitcoin Standard, which everyone listening should definitely read and check out. But, you know, this idea that Bitcoin and the rebirth and reinvention of money is something that happens in a, you know, once in a civilization, and we're very fortunate to be alive for it. But, you know, you don't, this is not the S&P 500. This is not, you know, a Vanguard index fund. This is a multi-decade or more project. And so if you are really that reactionary to, you know, the volatility that happens over, you know, 3, 6, 9 months, then maybe you need to reassess what job Bitcoin is doing in your portfolio.
Yeah, definitely. Okay, so what time is it? I know you're gonna have to get out of here at some point. What other advice would you have for people out there, or anything else that you kind of want to touch on?
Yeah, I mean, I think that for people that struggle with to set a baseline, I think that, you know, crypto and Bitcoin specifically is incredibly complex and interdisciplinary. And I think that can be very frustrating for a lot of people. It was very frustrating for me. I'm not a developer. I'm not an economist. So I think getting up to speed and understanding kind of even, and I don't fully understand it, but at a kind of, you know, very rudimentary level, how the protocol works and how the tech works is super intimidating. And I think there are, you know, there are now some really great resources. You know, Jameson Lopp has collected a ton of really good ones. One of my favorites is there's a Coursera course taught by a couple Princeton professors that gives like a very good but understandable technical overview of how Bitcoin works. And so just trying to not get too frustrated and stick with it, particularly on the technical side, it will eventually click. It clicked for me. You know, I tried off and on for, you know, 3 or 4 years to get into Bitcoin, and I just couldn't. But one day, you know, like, boom, you'll get it, and it will make sense. And so I think trying to figure out how to not get overwhelmed at the interdisciplinary nature of it is a key. So yeah, the other advice I would give, you know, I kind of focus and I've gotten much more interested in OPSEC. So I would say definitely get your OPSEC game tight. Never use a text message for second factor authentication. Use one of the good authentication tools or YubiKey. And yeah, I think that's very low, and a password manager. That's very low hanging fruit that most people don't do, but I think will be very important for the next wave of hodlers to get tight, because when hyper-Bitcoinization happens, that balance that is tiny in fiat today may be worth a lot more.
Yeah. Or, I thought about this, even just yesterday, I kind of had a check on myself. I had a sticker on a cup at work, and I walked into the break room and some coworkers of mine were kind of like, they had looked up the sticker, and then, it was innocent enough because he's a graphic design guy. But it made me rethink some things of like, okay, cause he kind of questioned like, oh, is this guy crypto rich, which I'm not, but people don't necessarily need to know how much you have to feel like, whether it's true or not, like you're a target worth attacking. So that made me kind of question some things of that I maybe broadcast a little too much.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a good point. And it goes back to the beauty of Bitcoin's origin story and Satoshi being anonymous. And it's just another reason why I think that Bitcoin has kind of an unbeatable origin story, that there will never be able to be it would be very difficult to have a truly, an origin story that could beat that. And the fact that, the coins have never moved, just shows you that is a very, very low time preference move to have your entire net worth be publicly viewable and seeing it, grow basically from zero to, billions of dollars and never touch it once. It's a kind of an amazing thing.
Yeah. Let's see. Okay, real quick. You and I kind of have a similar story in that we both, you started Proof of Take and I started this show for the similar reasons. Like, you didn't feel like at the time there was a lot of high quality, but accessible content that wasn't just like, here's why the price moved today. Why do you think that was at that time? I mean, I know probably early on that it was very much only available to the cypherpunks and then in more some other programmers and things like that, but I feel like now we're getting more of those good accessible educational resources, but why was there such a delay in that?
I mean, I think the business model of internet media is optimizing for eyeballs and clicks and not necessarily optimizing for good evergreen content. And so, some hyperbolic, kind of sensationalized title of an article, like, here's why, this is why Bitcoin is going to zero, or this is why you need to buy Bitcoin now, or this is why the news of, North Korea is going to kill Bitcoin or something like that. Having those clickbaity titles is what drives ad revenue on the internet. And so I think there's kind of perverse incentive for publishers who are monetizing via ads to not optimize for having good content, but to optimize for how to get the most eyeballs. And that's why I'm hopeful that we're going to see some newer experiments in media business models, like, you've got The Block. They're about to launch a paid product, and what people like Tony Shang are doing with kind of launching a subscription product. So hopefully that will raise the caliber. And I also think that just as more, Bitcoin is kind of this, has this like gravitational pull. I like to call it like an event horizon, which is basically like the point past a black hole where there's no return. And I think the Bitcoin rabbit hole is truly an event horizon. And so I think as it sucks in more and more intellectual capital, iron sharpens iron. And as there are more smart people putting out content, like, it makes you want to be better. When I see what the latest thing that Nick Carter puts out, or that Arjun Balaji puts out, or these, these really incredibly thoughtful and insightful writers, it just makes you want to be better and want to add to the, to the body of knowledge of this project.
Yeah, for sure. Well, very cool. Alex, how can people keep up with you?
Best way to do it is to troll me on Twitter. I'm at K Can't Hardly Wait, like the movie Can't Hardly Wait, except it's my last name instead. So find me there, and I would love to chat Bitcoin or anything.
And then the newsletter Proof of Take. How can people find
that? Yeah, it's proofoftake.substack.com. There's a link in my Twitter bio, so you can click that, subscribe, and you can get my unvarnished hot takes on the reg.
Cool. Very cool. Thanks for coming on.
Awesome. Thanks, Josh.
Okay, guys. I hope you enjoyed that interview with Alex Hardy. I know I have had a blast the last couple episodes when I can do in-person interviews. It's not going to work every time, but it's fun when we're able to do it. Something I picked up from this interview, or kind of remembered rather, is that Bitcoin doesn't care what your religious or cultural views are or what faith you practice. Obviously, Alex and I don't necessarily share all of that, but you know, the beauty of Bitcoin is that it doesn't care. It's honest money, which means, as far as I'm aware, there's no religious views that say that it is heretical or whatever. You know, there's no religious group, to my understanding, that bans it, because who wouldn't want honest money? So yeah, y'all go follow Alex on Twitter, subscribe to his Proof of Take newsletter, and if you want to support the show, remember the best thing you can do is always just subscribe so you don't miss any episodes, and then share it out all over the internet to everyone you know. And if you want to support more directly, you can go to bottomshelfbitcoin.com/donate and see all the ways to donate there. In other news, I was able to, most of you guys know that I run bitcoinmeritbadge.com, which is kind of like patches, Velcro patches that are just kind of funny Bitcoin things. But I got Lightning up and working on that, which is a big deal because, you know, it still feels weird paying for something that's like $10 with an on-chain transaction. So Lightning just kind of smooths that out, and just because who wants to make that on-chain transaction with fees plus waiting for 6 confirmations or whatever? And it's like, it's on Lightning now, it just works. So yeah, you can go check that out if you want to. And then always, you know, follow me on Twitter, bottomshelfbtc, DM me or just at me any kind of questions you want answered or people you think I should interview, let me know. And yeah, that's pretty much it for this week. Until next time, from Bottom Shelf Bitcoin, I'm Josh Humphrey. Thanks for listening.